The last time I was in this building, it brought back bad memories to come back here. I was at a meeting and we stayed up at the one on the top. Is that Glenview or whatever that is up there? But I came down the hill to get a little exercise. I was jogging down the hill and fell. And I really fell. And so couldn't do anything about it. I knew I had to go back up the hill, so I decided to come on in here and make my phone call while I was here. And there was blood on the outside of here and the outside of here and under here. But I decided I'm here. I might as well make the phone call because there's no phone up there. No one to call home. So I'm dialing the phone, and the phone booth starts turning around. And for those of you, some of you know me, this is not unusual. I faint easy. So I sat on the floor and did what I know to do, and so the phone booth stopped roaring around. So I tried again, and it's still busy. So then I decide, well, maybe I better head back up to the hill and get this attended to. So I got as far as the door to the lobby, and the lobby door started moving too. So I sat down on the floor again and stayed there longer that time, and there was nobody around. And I said, well, Lord, I've got to get back out to the hill and get some help. I've got to go back up there. And this time I made it out to the little pilings they have around the driveway and realized I could not, the whole Glen was moving at that point. So I sat down on the pilings and put my head between my legs, and then I saw a car, one car sitting out front. And I said, Lord, there's somebody in there so they can help me. So just help me to get inside again, and then there'll be somebody there that can help me. So I did. I started up the walk and came in and fainted right inside the doorway. And that's typical for me. I don't have one embarrassing moment. I have a lifetime of embarrassing moments. So the people who picked me up and carried me up to the hill and laid me on my bed, which I had just thrown under clothes and everything because we had a real short time to exercise, was Jerry White and Marv Smith. So, you know, here I am. It made my day. And I was really hurt. So, and they said the shock and the altitude was the thing that caused me to faint. And the nurse drove up right behind me, and so she attended to me and took my blood pressure and all this jazz. And so they kept me in bed for the rest of that day, and most of the next day I couldn't walk up and down the hill any in this arm. I couldn't get in the tub or dress myself, or so totally embarrassing. The workshop you're hearing this morning was the paper I had to present the day after I fell down the mountain. So the Lord has very unique ways of humbling you and making you dependent on Him. And so I guess I thank Him for that. So anyway, you are getting blood, sweat, and tears in this workshop. Why don't we take a minute and just pray? Thank you, Lord, for these women, for the lives that they represent, for the love that they represent, that you've invested in each one. Thank you, Father, for the things that you're teaching us this week, for those who have given us the opportunity to come and to just step away. And we pray, Lord, that in the midst of the fun and the times with people and the wonderful messages and all that's going on to keep us so busy, we pray that we might see you in the midst of it all. And Lord, this morning as we get into this time together, we pray that you would teach us how to have relationships with people that would be honoring to you and that would be uplifting to those that we're in contact with. Father, you'll have to teach us to do this, because we can't do this in our own power and in our own will. We often don't want to. So we would commit these areas of our lives to you and those people that each one of us are involved with. And we ask that you would use the words that we share this morning to change our attitudes and our actions and our thinking processes in terms of relationships. that we might bring honor and glory to you, who created us and chose us and called us to be your representative. And we'd ask these things in your precious name. Amen. Some of you I don't know very well. I'll just tell you a little bit about me. I'm Daryl Sanders' wife, and we are now in California via Tennessee. We've been there almost 2.5 years, and we love it, but we miss some other people. We have 3 children, 3 girls. I have a 13-year-old at home going on probably 20 at least. And then I have in Tennessee 2 daughters, 1 28 and 1 24, that are married, and I have 2 grandsons, age 1 and 3, and plenty of pictures whenever you'd like to see them. We met the Navigators in 66. Well, before that, really. We came to Christ in 63. Met the Navigators probably in 64, 5, somewhere in there. And we're good friends of Dale and Larly and Carrie and Carol and Terry before they met the Navigators. And we're good friends with Bob and Jan Lewis and Bob and Yvonne Potter. And every one of those mentioned has been a great help and encouragement to us and our deep friends, even though we're separated and have been for some years in terms of distance. So that'll give you a little bit of a background on us. The workshop this morning, and I'm going to pass out. Oh, I'm going to trip on this yet. I did that before you came. I'm still doing it. Yeah, please. That's enough for that row. You don't need near this many, so I think that'll do it. Let me ask you, as those things are being passed out, and we'll be working through them together, how would you describe, what are the qualities of friendship? And don't think Christian or non-Christian, just think friendship.
Trust.
Mm-hmm.
Loyalty. Acceptance.
Yeah.
Honesty.
Yeah. Let me just challenge you. The Lord challenged me with my daughter a couple of weeks ago in relationship to this. They're studying in school relationships, parents and peers and the whole thing. And they had to draw a poster writing about showing pictures of friendship. And she came up with this thing that I thought was excellent. As I thought of friendship and what it really is, I can't draw like she did. I was going to bring it, but they had it on the bulletin board at school, and they didn't want to take it down yet. So, but she put at the top expressions of friendship, and then she drew caricatures of people with different expressions on their faces. And one was happiness, one was sadness, one was anger, one was surprise, one was fear, and she wound up again with happiness. Which she could have said trust, but the kids wouldn't understand that much. And you know, as I thought about that, and I thought about my relationship with my husband, who is my best friend, that's what friendship is. You have all those qualities. It isn't all honesty, or happiness, or trust, or acceptance. Friendship is composed of all those things. And it's a process of working through the ones that are hard to make friendship real. And I just loved that. I just felt like God gave me that, and I thanked God that He had given her that, that her understanding was clear enough that she saw that friends are not just a bed of roses and happy times, but there are issues that we work through. If you'll look at your paper, I want to read this first part to you. Langdon Gilkey's book, The Shantung Compound, is a story of a concentration camp in North China. Gilkey was a young agnostic professor observing camp life and was completely unimpressed by any need for religion. He writes, "It is not that I thought religion wrong. I simply thought it irrelevant. essential if someone wanted it, but of no value for the common life of mankind. He observed that the community being organized to function apart from religion by experts to prove religion unnecessary. It was only as he saw the things the system could not provide, purpose for life, service to one another, rules that maintain dignity and hope, that he discovered what religious people had to offer. He said, "There is a quality unique to the missionary group, naturally and without pretense, to respond to a need which everyone else recognized, only to turn aside. Much of this went unnoticed, but our camp could scarcely have survived as well as it did without it. If there were any evidences of the grace of God, they were to be found among these people." I think that's a perfect picture of our world. And not just our outside world, outside the Christian frame of reference, but inside the Christian frame of reference. God burdened my heart on relationships, not just with women, but across the board. Years ago, and God did some things in Daryl's and my heart to cause us to make some decisions, to work on those areas in our own marriage, first of all, and then in our life. And the workshop today is a result of what God has been doing in our life for a number of years in these areas. Continuing to read on the first page, I won't read any more, but just this. Christians in today's society are being observed as closely as were those missionaries in the Shantung compound. We are given daily opportunities to make Christianity relevant to life, and we can be assured that there are those who watch and record in their hearts what they see. It was toward this same end that Christ spent his last hours on earth praying for his disciples in John 17. His prayer was for unity, love, and support, that through these qualities his followers might make the world hungry for the Father. In the area of relating to women, these three concerns have a special significance. We took a survey I did on the West Coast, and we included some of the women in the Southeast because we had been there before. And then Marilyn Ganico took one in the Middle Division. Hi, Joan. Come in. No problem. It's a long walk.
I was just upstairs.
Okay. There's a handout, Joan. Could you give her one of those? What was I saying? Okay, so Marilyn Ganico sent out a survey, and I did too. And we asked several questions. We have not included them in here, but there were questions like, what is your relationship today to the person who trained you? What is your relationship to those who are your peers? And what is your relationship to those whom you trained today? And we got some very interesting responses back. We had other questions beside those two, but we wanted feedback on current relationships because we tend to live in the past or in the future. And then things happen that cause problems, and we want to just avoid that and think about the past and wonder, will it ever be fixed, so we can have this goal that we had back in the beginning of the relationship. And the answer to that is no, it will not be like it was in the beginning, because none of our relationships with any of our friends are like they were in the beginning. If they are, they're not growing. And so you need to examine all relationships, children, husband, whatever, in the light that they need to change. And it's almost like we were talking about this with some women in a Bible study. This woman was under conviction about losing her first love. People can really get under conviction about that. And when I got to examining, I am glad I lost the first love I had for my husband. I'm glad it's changed. It was totally wrong. It was not God-honoring at all, and I'm glad that God has given us the kind of love that he wants. So I haven't lost the love I had for him. It's changed. And it's grown. And we have a friend in here, too. So. Okay. Let's move on. Joan, one thing I'll review you in that I'm trying to establish here is that friendship is not happiness, trust, acceptance, happy times. Friendship is composed of happiness and fear and anger and worry and surprise and all those other elements that we don't like to know about, but that's part of them. Okay, if I can get myself organized here, continue on. I'm going to be going back and forth referring to some of the things that Marilyn sent in on her paper also. She used a book by Janet Cobabel, I think is her name. It's the InterVarsity Press, and it's called But Can She Type? It speaks primarily to single women, but there are a lot of things that we can use as married women in our relationships with women also. Okay, the first on your outline, you'll see the first thing I want to talk about is the idea of unity. And the first goal under unity in terms of our relationships has to do with our identification with Christ. You know, in the old days, and I have some old days, some of you have some older days around the Navigators than I do, but I have old days too. And in the old days, my association with the Navigators, Daryl's and mine, was to the group that we saw. We were attracted by what they were doing with their lives, by their goals, by their fulfillment in what they were doing, as well as by individuals. I think today one of the things that's happened, the organization has changed so much and is continuing to change. Sometimes people are afraid that we're losing the vision, or often, even in the older days, some would interpret the vision one way, some would interpret the vision the other way. And a lot of disagreements come from that. Women have to be united around the person of Christ, an identification with Him more than with the organization, because it's going to change. Your role is going to change. Your relationships are going to change. But your relationship with Christ is always there, growing, and His love doesn't get any better than it was the first day you met Him. You experience it more. So our identification at this point cannot be around the organization. We can be loyal to it, and we want to, and I'm a diehard Navigator. But I would have been one if I hadn't been a Navigator, if you understand that, because God called us to do this. So there has to be, with the women that we're involved with, a strong relationship with Christ. When you establish a strong relationship with Christ, you establish security and intimacy for these women. And that's what they need. You see, we look for intimacy and security in two ways. We look for it in roles or in relationships. And you can't look for it in those because they change. You all have examples of people in your ministry and examples in your own life when you've had situations where you've been in roles that you really have enjoyed and when you've been in roles that you really hated. And your husbands also. And when your husbands are in those roles, you quickly take up their defense. And so you found from your own experience that either roles or relationships don't provide intimacy, maybe for a short time, and they don't provide security for you because they change. They're always changing. They're never stable. And the women today that we see around us are looking for those things. They're also looking for security and intimacy in roles and relationships. I want to, in your handout, you have, if I can find mine, several surveys. I have the first one you have is some surveys from freshman women that we took at the freshman class of 1990. I think that's on your second page. Let me read through a couple of these. It's very interesting. I don't know how many of you are involved in campus ministries or exactly what you're all involved with, but wherever you're coming from, the women you're dealing with today are different, especially if they're younger women, than they were when I grew up. Some of the things, the statement, having children is very important or essential to me. 63% of the women agreed, 14% strongly disagreed. Living together before marriage is acceptable, 36% of the women agreed. It's essential to be established in my career before marriage. 43% of the women agreed. 31% of the men agreed. That's astounding to me. It's a total reversal. And then, if marriage begins to hinder one's personal fulfillment and happiness, divorce is an acceptable solution. Women 36%, men 38%. Statement, being financially secure is a very important objective for my life. This was a little lower, but it's still high from women's perspective, 32% as opposed to men's 76%. And then if you look at the next page of your handout, there's a survey they took in Seattle this year of the values of people, and I've underlined several on there for you. Over 80% desire honesty, trust, loyalty, openness, sincerity, and good communications in relationships. And then 45% see relationships as the most important things in their lives. That's quite a statement. Because you see what they're saying. Their security is coming from their role or their relationship. And neither one of those are stable. They may think they will be, but they won't be. And they haven't learned that yet. Daryl and I are experimenting. Often, the young people that you are involved in helping, and for us that means young couples, say, in their late 20s, early 30s, are beginning to establish their career, and they all have young kids, and are so busy you can't get any time with them. So one of the things we're doing, we're experimenting, we have no idea if it'll work, we are sort of maintaining fellowship, relationship with them, and sort of giving out little nuggets as we go along, but not expecting anything, not challenging. We're waiting for one of these things, the roles or the relationships, to begin to hurt. And when that happens, they're going to come. Because we've seen it already happen in our next door neighbors, and it's been exciting to watch God do that. But we have figured out why beat your brains out trying to get people to do things they don't want to do. Just work on a relationship, keeping that relationship going, nurturing it, living your life before them, letting them see values, letting them see relationships that are built on something that's unchanging. And so anyway, that's our perspective right now, because if you say over 80% desire honesty, trust, loyalty, openness, sincerity, and good communications in relationships, what has the Christian community communicated to the secular world over this past year?
Disaster.
All the opposite of those things. So we have no audience. And we have to establish an audience through relationships. And the premise here that I'd like to establish is if they don't see that relationship, they often don't see you with your peers in the working environment. They see you alone. But we see one another as peers. And we know the struggles that we have in relationships as peers that are unresolved. And we need to see those things resolved in our life. And in our relationships with one another, in order for us to believe God can do it out there. Because theirs are much more complicated than ours are. Ours look piddly compared to theirs. There's so many struggles they're going through. Look at your next issues in women's work. And let's go through this just a few minutes to help you understand a little bit more. I don't know if it's any different for those of you, I think it's across the country, that things are changing so quickly. One of our women that's at Stanford University did a survey of, she just got married, and so she did a synopsis of her time at Stanford and what God did. And these are some of the conclusions that she came to and some of the things that God used there to help her understand the women. Many of the women desired to enter male-dominated fields, and few reported no desire for career. Although recognizing the desires for career and family could conflict, they indicate their problem could be solved by finding husbands who would respect their career ambitions and share housekeeping and child-rearing responsibilities. Many indicated their careers would take priority over family responsibilities and that they would chuck the family over the career. We need to search the scriptures for a biblical model of womanhood to present as an alternative. You know, I thought about that statement. When you came around the navigators, what was used as your role model for what a navigator woman should look like? You can think back on that. Yeah, another wife. What was the scripture that was shared? Proverbs 31. How many of you ever became a Proverbs 31 woman? Do you know that God freed me up? I'm not saying we threw out Proverbs 31. There are many, many things in there that God can use. But do you know that you have to be a grandmother before your children rise up and call you blessed? And read that in context. Her children rose up and called her blessed. And that woman had a lot of things going. But we don't know what time in her life she had those things going. So I've determined, this is my own application, that she was a grandmother. And she was free to do a lot of those things she was doing and to give of her time. Because if you ask a young wife and mother to look at Proverbs 31 and do all those things, what are the results? Burnout. Discouragement. Or they'll look at some other wife who has a lot more capacity than they do and think that she's doing it, when that one knows she isn't either. She can just put up a better front. But see, we put up such high role models that we need to bring a realistic view of ourselves to those young lives that we're involved in. And look at scripture realistically. That's why a biblical model of womanhood. If you were working with one of these women that I'm talking about today, and you read to her Proverbs 31, what would she zero in on? Right. Working. I had a woman, and this is true. When we were in Memphis, a gal who had been involved in the women's lib movement, heavily before she got married, came to me, and she was ready to get married. And they had been involved in the ministry with us for a while, and she said, "Volly, I need to talk to you. I'm going to get married, and there are two views of women in the scriptures that I see." And she said, there's one in Ephesians, and she described it this way. These are not my words, but I love it. She said, the woman in Ephesians is happy, 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 apron, 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 kitchen, kitchen, kitchen. And she would never say a word against any decision her husband made. She would never disagree with him. And she was always content to stay at home. That was her description of Ephesians. And then she said, there's a woman in Proverbs 31. And she said, this woman is, now I can't even remember, I didn't write this down, this is unplanned. She said, this woman is makes decisions on her own. She's working when she wants to. Her husband rises up and calls her blessed. And she said, her next words were, can I choose which of these wives I want to be? And see, that was, how long ago was that? That had to be 8 years ago. And the women since then have gone further into that thinking pattern. And so we've got to understand where they're coming from. In order to build relationships, we have to know what's important to them and how to begin to change their value systems and do that. So that's why I'm going into this with you today, and I hope that it's helpful. We have to present biblical roles and standards for single women, wives, and mothers. That's why it's going to be on your back to find out what is a biblical role model. You have to examine the scriptures and find out not what you have always interpreted as meaning, and it may very well mean that, but God give me freedom to help these women where they live today and show me how to do that, to show them how they can live with biblical standards. The high divorce rate, we're on the bottom now. The troubled or broken families have produced a student who is increasingly less emotionally mature. Those of you who are in campus ministries are finding out that what used to take maybe 1 year to 2 years to accomplish is taking 4 or 5 to accomplish because of the emotionally immature student that you have. They can't begin to understand what you're talking about. The high divorce rate, the poor parental models have resulted in children who are scarred, and they hinder them from growing. Parents of students have been inconsistent in discipline, and they've given them material things to substitute for the time and the attention that they needed to give them. And on top of that, the universities have compounded this by shielding students from the consequences of failure. These influences have resulted in women who are insecure and self-seeking, but you would never know it to look at them. Their insecurity is masked by a projected image of competence and academic success and financial success. And after this gal had talked to several of these women and spent time and got close to them, she began to see underneath how much they were hurting. The women have fear of failure, and it's so strong, to take steps of faith for them is very difficult. There is a strong tendency to master the external skills of ministry and to ignore the inside work that God wants to do, because they would like to be able to conquer that in the same way they conquer the skills of the ministry. They just don't have the heart. Our need is to structure and develop the ministry to facilitate the building of trust relationships, which are required to identify root issues and contribute to the healing of long-standing fears and emotional wounds. We have to give them opportunities so they can learn to walk by faith. You know, the way you learn to walk by faith is to fail. That's the only way. For a number of reasons, now we have a much longer period with people. The training of a student in developing Christ-like character is taking an increasingly long time. Sometimes it takes from 4 to 8 years to get them where they need to be in order to really labor effectively. And part of what you have to do in building those relationships is to build up a bond of trust between you and that person. We will need to figure out how to follow the disciples rather than seeking to pass them on to other staff and other ministries who do not have the trust relationship. Because, see, it takes so long to establish it that if they graduate from college and you have been working all that time to establish it, then you put them into another ministry, they've got to start completely over, because that's what they're going on, are those relationships. That's all they know to go on until they learn to trust God and walk by faith. There's a man called George Marsden, and he has talked about the Christianity Today, and he says this. He wrote this in the book Christianity Today. A content analysis of evangelical preaching in the 19th century today would reveal an astounding shift from magnifying divine glory and power to magnifying human glory and power. And this is in the evangelical community. There's just been a big shift where we used to talk about sacrifice and submitting to Christ. Now we talk about God giving us stuff and honoring us. And it has had a negative effect on the secular world. And it has hurt us. To that end, let me share a little thing that God has done. As I said, our neighbors have come to Christ. We've been there 2 years and we have been praying for our whole neighborhood. And we've seen our next door neighbors come to Christ. We started having a study with them in the book of John, and to explain where they're coming from, they're a young couple. and have their first baby is about 8 months old now. But you only have to look at his license plate on his truck to know where he's coming from. You're embarrassed to read it, literally. And we, and right or wrong, I don't know, we're experimenting. Let's just say this. We determined that in our neighborhood, we were not going to tell them what we did unless they ask us, and then we'd come up with some other name for what we did. We were not going to initiate discussions with Christ unless God did it through some other means. And he has with a couple in the neighborhood. We've been involved in some direct evangelism with some of them. But primarily what we're doing is trying to reach out and build relationships and love them. And some of the silly things we've done are cut grass for them. Daryl's back went out after cutting 3 yards and he was going to serve them. This is just a funny thing God did. His back went out. He wound up in bed. The men were so shocked. Nobody had ever cut their yard before. They came over, found out he had done it. So while he was in bed for a month, they cut our yard. So the Lord just reversed what we had planned, but used it because they wanted to help. The ones who have come to Christ, their yard adjoins ours, and part of their grass is part of our grass. So whenever we cut that part, we always cut theirs. We've always done that ever since we moved in, ever after the grass grew. And whenever the trash man comes, we would push their trash can up and set it by their fence just the same way we do ours. And just little things, you know, talking and asking questions and building relationships and doing things like that in whatever way we can. Well, we had no idea anything was happening with these people. And we had not invited them to church. We didn't really want to invite them to church because we thought it would not be good. And so one day Daryl was out in the yard and the gal had her baby while we lived there. And she had talked to me about how having the baby was not going to change anything. I was talking to her one day about how it would change your life when you had a baby. And she said, oh no, I'm going to be back to work in 6 weeks and nothing will change. And so then they had the baby. And pretty soon they began coming over and asking questions. And I must establish the fact we're the grandparents on the block, so everybody's younger. So we're official grandparents there. But anyway, to make a long story short, he began to tell Daryl that he was drinking. Unsolicited. And he said, would you pray for me? We had never said anything about Christ. Never. And he said, would you please pray that I can quit drinking? And so Daryl said he would and said a few things to him. And then a couple weeks later, he came over in tears and was crying and said he was drinking worse and he was going to have to quit his job and he needed to go to church. That was his solution to it. And so he wanted to go to church with us. So we said, for sure, come on, we'll take you to church. So we decided to take him to Sunday school. We go to a young couple's class and kind of co-teach that. And Daryl's working with several of the guys in there, so we knew the couples. And so we wanted them to feel at home. So they went and enjoyed it. And then we had some contact. We went out to dinner with them. And we hadn't been out to dinner with non-Christians in a long time. So we were wondering, what do we do here? So we decided we weren't going to do anything. We'd kind of let the Lord lead this thing, and whatever they want to talk about, we talk about. We sat down, 10 minutes after we sat down, we were bombarded with questions. Not about what do you do, but about how long have you been married? How, we see you walking together, we see you working together in the yard. How do you keep your marriage like that? Why does your daughter help you like that? Why don't we see her doing things we see other kids doing. See, what they were doing was looking at values and life. They didn't know where they came from. But we were bombarded. So that night, Daryl got to share his testimony with them. And then they asked me, because she's sort of like me in background. And we just had a wonderful time. We wound up staying 3 hours with them, and Kisa babysat for them, and everything was great. They even paid for the meal, which we had We were blown away at all that happened. Then they said, we didn't mention any more about going to church, but they said, we really want to know how you came to believe this. We really want to understand what you're talking about. So Daryl suggested, well, how about if we just get together and look at the Bible and learn about who Jesus is, because he's the one who taught us this. And so we did. We had a Bible study with him and covered only about the first 6 verses in the first chapter of John. Had a ball. They asked question after question, just green as they could be. No understanding. Her father, her grandmother is Jewish. Her father is Italian. She had all kind of Catholic and Jewish traditions mixed in there. But one question, and the whole reason I share this story, a question John asked us that night. His mother had found out that they were going to have Bible study, and that was totally foreign to her. And so she said, why are those people doing this? And that got John to thinking. And so we'd finished the Bible study, and we were ready to go. In fact, we were going to leave an hour before that, and they had kept us there asking questions. And so John said, Daryl, I got to ask you a question, and I hope this doesn't offend you. But he said, why are you doing this? And we had the wonderful opportunity of telling them that they knew that we had become Christians a number of years ago, and that before we moved here, we had prayed for the people that were on our street, and that we had determined that we would love them, and that we would be friends with them as much as they would let us, and that if they wanted us to, that we would share who Jesus was with them. And he went, phew. And you could just see the tension falling off of him, because he didn't know what we wanted. And we said, hey, if you decide you never want to have Bible study again, that's fine. We're still going to cut your grass. And we're still going to bring you food over and do all this stuff, because you're our friends. To top that all off, they had not come to Christ then. They came to Christ, and I won't even go into all this. But in the process of coming to Christ, he had to go through an alcohol and drug rehabilitation program after he beat his wife. And then they came to Christ. And one of the things that happened, the program he was in was to cure not just that problem, but allergy problems. And so there were 2 women in the program who were Christians who were going through it with him. Well, they were very strong dogmatic Christians. And he, after the program was over and his wife had come back to him, he wanted to have them over for dinner to thank him for being their friends. And he wanted to have us over too. We didn't know why, because we'd never met them. So we went over and we interacted with all of them over dinner and the whole thing. And we had no more gotten home than the phone rang. And he said, hey, we want to go to church with you tomorrow. And he said, do you know why we ask you to dinner? We said, uh-uh, we never know what's going to come out of this guy's mouth. And so Daryl said, no, we don't. And he says, for protection. And he says, you know what? You're my friend. And he said, I know that you love me, and you're not going to put pressure on me the way that those Christians did. I know they're Christians, but you're my friend. And, you know, I just thanked God. And I'll cry if I don't be careful. Because that was a relationship that had been built up over 2 years that God had done. And we're friends. And they know that. And they can call on us, and we go back and forth. And our daughter went over the other night for them to help her with her math. They were so excited that she was doing that. And just building this, and you know what it comes from? The identification with Christ that we have to have comes from intimacy with him. And so often we get away from that. And so many of you women that I'll be talking to this week, not necessarily those of you in this room, but so many of you have gotten away from that intimacy with him. And you can't let yourself do it, because you can't handle the changes in your roles and your relationships without that intimacy with Christ that doesn't change. So that's where your identification comes from, is that intimacy with him that comes out of your life. when those in the organization see you and when those see you. And so that's the first. And then identification with group is the second session under unity. We are not going to finish. There is no way we're going to finish. So I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. One of the things that we said, identification with a group is under, I'd call it identification with family. Many of the young women that you work with don't even know what the vision is. They have heard it, their husbands have it, some of them, but it isn't theirs. The first gal we ever had live with us, she said, "Would you please help follow up me?" Do you know, I realized when she said that, I had never searched the scriptures on my own to find out if the scriptures taught follow-up. I had other people tell me it did, but I didn't know if it was my conviction or not. And I had to lead this girl who had been an intervarsity leader for 4 years and had traveled in Europe, and I was a little podunk high school graduate. So I had to know what I was talking about and make it my conviction before I could share it from a heart. So that's what I talk about. Identification with a group has to be centered around the things that God has put on your heart individually. You can embrace a vision as a group for a while, but sooner or later, it's got to be yours. God's got to make it yours. And there are many other things I can say, but I'm not going to do it. Let me read you something from Marilyn Ganico's paper here. I thought this was very interesting. Page 8. There are women, and you've been around the ministries long enough to recognize these as I go through them. There are women, and I'm going to relate this to the Navigator women. I'll explain it as from the marketplace first. Esther Harding wrote this. Women in careers move through three phases in regard to role identity. The initial stage she calls the masculine masquerade. At this stage, she tries to enhance her masculine qualities to gain entrance into the masculine world. Phrases like remain unnoticed as a woman, be like one of the guys, never be accused of being like a woman, describe the mode. Can I suggest that there's also a navigator masquerade? We all do that. We all want to look like those navigators around us, never differing from them. And you know, we complain about our kids not wanting to be any different from their peers. We do the same thing. So that's the first stage. The second stage is the sophistication stage she calls occupied with the occupation. At this stage, she is settled into the organization and working directly for what she wants. She becomes absorbed in a cause, an ideal she's dedicated to. She bases all relationships on the job and doesn't deny her womanhood, only avoids facing who she really is as a woman. This stage in the Navigator profile, a woman comes into a point in her life where she says, "Can I really do this?" She's examining, did God really call her to do this, or did he just call her husband to do this? What is her role? Can she make disciples? Can she help women? Can she build relationships? It's when she's really being absorbed in that. That's where a lot of women, they may go off to training pros and gain the skills and things they need to do, but the heart and the maturity to really apply those is not there. It's almost like you would describe your child in the stage of their life from, let's say, 5 to 12, if we're lucky, because they're eager to get information and to gain it, and so they're open to learning. And so that's where the woman is in this stage. The next stage this woman calls, it says she may or may not enter the next phase. It's called the harmony phase, where she recognizes her masculine and feminine qualities. At this point, women shifted their careers to the wings and pressed their social and personal lives into the limelight. How much of that do we see? Women who have decided on careers, then found out they weren't satisfying or fulfilling, and so then they decide they got to have a baby. And so because they recognize they are a woman and they do want some of these things. The way I express this in some women, is it hits at different ages, but quite a number it hits at around 30, 35, somewhere in that area, where we are coming before God and we are struggling with who we are and what our gifts are. And can God really use us? That may happen again. I just turned 47, so I don't know what's going to happen when I hit 50, but I have a feeling there's something coming up. But most women, I don't think I've seen an exception, go through that time when they're reevaluating who they are. Can God really use their life? Are they really who they say they are? And in that point, they gain freedom in their relationship with Christ, and they're beginning to get maturity to let God use the gifts and not feel like they have to be like somebody else or be used in the same way that God is using somebody else. And it's a freeing up and it's a rest that comes. And as I say, I don't know what's next. This is as far as I've gone in my life. But I've seen God do it in my life, and I've seen Him do it in many other women's lives. So those that you are working with, your continuity in relationships during that period and your acceptance and love of them is very, very important, because they don't feel loved or approved or any of the above. They're hurting at that time. Then under unity again, relationships within the group. Recently, I think Margaret Chase Smith, the past senator, just died recently, I think. But she was on the Today Show a while back, and she said this statement: women are their own worst enemies. They have not learned to support each other. Men have the very same battles that women do, battles of jealousy and competition, but they don't show it, and women do. And isn't that true of us? We've had people say to us Southerners that your sweetness and light, we may look that way and sound that way because of our soft voices, but let me assure you, it is not true. There's no sweetness and light inside. We're just like the rest of the country. We've learned to cover. We've been taught to cover as Southerners. That's a part of our upbringing, I think. And we have to learn to deal with that ourselves. But I think some of the things that we've learned, and one of the things I was talking about with one of the gals that was in the ministry in Memphis a while back, we had kids who were alumni, and the men and women were about the same age, about the same maturity level. They were all laboring, and they were all at the age where they were really beginning to think about marriage. And so one of the things that happened during that time that's typical with the navigators is that a man would date a woman for a while, and then he would date her exclusively, and then he would drop her, decide that that's not the one God had for him, so then he would drop her. And so we watched this happen a couple times, and then we made a rule. I don't know if you should have done this, but because these kids were living in the same apartment complex, guys and girls, you know, like two guys' apartments, two girls' apartments, they were dating each other. So a guy may date this girl for 2 weeks and she's got stars in her eyes after the first date and she's planning the wedding. Then he drops her and he dates her roommate. He's going to date her for 2 weeks. Do the same thing. Well, we decided you don't date a girl more than twice, because women can handle, they have to learn to handle jealousy. You're going to have to live with that the rest of your life. Some of us more than others have trouble with jealousy. But rejection is another ballgame. So you don't begin to date that girl exclusively until you and she have established a friendship and a relationship where you know that she's the one. And we saw God do that. We saw those girls having to deal in their apartments with being jealous of the guy they dated last week, who they may be madly in love with. They... their roommate. But I saw them go to God and deal with jealousy. And it was healthy. And many of them married. Larley knows lots of those kids are married and on staff, and lots of them are here. But the idea of relationships, you have to come out. What is the thing that is going to be the least destructive? Rejection is more destructive than jealousy. So that was how we handled that. But you always have to work through relationships within a group. One of the things that happened, and I know you're familiar with the Philippians 4 women. I can't pronounce them. Those two women that had fusses. You know who they are. And Paul called them his co-laborers in the gospel. You might be interested. You probably know this. Euodia's name suggests one who has arrived. So if you can picture her in your mind as probably being a sharp lady who has everything together and never has a problem, one who has arrived. And I call the other one Syntyche. And her name means that she's a good mixer. So she probably was totally unorganized. But she loved people. So you can just look at those two people and see why they would have conflict. And that's why most of the times we have conflicts within a group. Because we're judging one another. And we're comparing the way that we view a situation in the light of our gifts and abilities and the way someone else is viewing it. One instance we've had in our lives, relationships within a group, has to do with someone thinking you're not a leader because you don't make snap decisions. And you, at the same time, knowing exactly why you didn't make a snap decision, but him judging you because you didn't, thinking you're not a leader because you didn't. And there are all kind of these things. But just to think through on your own life and why we would tend to judge other people as not being effective or adequate to do the job God's given them, and just why we tend to judge them in those ways. Edith Schaefer wrote in the book, What is a Family? Criticism of each other may be very necessary at times, but there must be encouraged sensitivity to the fact that the whole point of communication is to have a growing relationship come forth. If criticism is degenerating into simply a power struggle, one needs to stop short and ask, what is more important, our relationship as a whole or convincing them I'm right? I was sharing with Jeannie Hamilton this morning. We were up forever talking, but just to illustrate this is just recent. Daryl comes home from a trip, and so there's no places in the parking area to park, so I have to park way in the boonies. So I tell him I'll come around and pick him up after he gets his luggage. And he can just walk across the street into the parking lot and I'll be right there. So I did that. Worked out fine. Next week he's gone again, so he comes back and I go pick him up again. Well, I do the same thing in the parking. So he's been gone more the past 3 months than he's been home. He hasn't had three or four days home straight in about 3 months. And we've been doing this. So I tell him the same thing, because the car is way down there. I tell him the same thing, that I'm going to go pick up the car and he can walk across. He doesn't hear me. Or I assume that he heard me. So I go get the car and he's getting the luggage. And so I'm sitting there waiting where I said I would be waiting. He's standing up there waiting where he said he'd be waiting. Half an hour. He's been gone for a week. Finally, he sees me. So he gets in the car, and I'm telling our life. I'm just telling it like it is. He gets in the car and is very upset, to say the least. And I'm mad because he doesn't realize I've been worried someone's kidnapped him. And he's insensitive to my feelings, and I'm mad at him because he's responding wrong. And so there we go, like this, you know, for about 10 minutes into the drive. He's been gone forever. I'm not kidding. And finally he said, okay, we are not going to waste this little time we have together in arguing over this. And I want to tell you this. We didn't ask forgiveness of one another. We just said, okay, this is dead. This is foolish. This is stupid. We're not going to waste our time on it. Let's just talk and forget everything that happened in the last 15 minutes. And we did. And it's okay. And that's what I'm talking about. That is not important enough to ruin the little bit of time we have together. It doesn't matter who was right. It doesn't matter who understood wrong or any of that. The relationship is more important than the issue is. One of the things I read in Decision Magazine recently, it said some guidelines on maintaining unity. Criticism is an opportunity to die to self. If you ever heard anything about Billy Graham and the way he responds to criticism, he just sends a beautiful example in that area. When someone criticizes you, commit the emotional response to God and evaluate the criticism and learn from it. And the reason they say emotional response is because you always have one. If someone criticizes you, you always have an emotional response. Doesn't matter how long you've walked with God. It has nothing to do with it. Don't keep score as to who does the most for the work. And that's very important. Because I know many of you women have not gotten credit for much that you have done and never will. Except from one person. And he's the one who counts. And he's the one we're doing it for. Don't keep responding to hurts from the past. And that's important. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that later on. Y'all have any questions before we go into the second?
What was that first thing you said about criticism?
It's an opportunity to die to self. Okay. As women that are getting closer towards the Navigator organization see us interacting as peers and taking the initiative, that's going to make them hungry for Christ. And I love that term, hungry for Christ, because that's our goal with women, is to create in them a thirst and a hunger for Him. And we do that through our relationships and the values they see communicated as a result of our relationship with Christ, which is the key relationship. Okay, let's move on to love. Love involves four things: acceptance, commitment with mutual accountability, perseverance, and forgiveness. Let me read something else from her paper here. The issue of acceptance. You have to teach women to work with and for women, especially those women who are in your ministry. One of the surveys suggested that, and you can read this in any secular magazine that has to do with women in the marketplace, women don't respect women bosses as much as they do men bosses. They have a different standard for women than they do for men. And so that goes into the Navigator organization also. And we've seen it demonstrated in some women coming to a team meeting and feeling like if all the women weren't invited, then the women weren't represented. And see, that's a little nitpicky thing. But that's part of what happens in not accepting people for who they are. One of the letters from the survey said there is a need to help women discover biblical principles, but let them be flexible as to how they apply them and creative. Focus more on convictions than traditions and give women room to fail. To say that you can only do the Navigator ministry one way is to be very judgmental and very non-accepting of those who have different gifts and abilities. God used John 21 in my life a number of years ago, still is. But just the idea of John accepting Peter with what he could give him, when he could give it. That's true in your children. Not expecting more from them than they can give you at the moment. Because we tend to do that. Jesus said to Peter, feed my sheep whether you love me right or not. Just do it. And that's what he says to us. I accept you like you are and just do what I've asked you to do like you are. I'll work on the rest. Edith Schaefer also speaks on the issue of acceptance. And this is one of my favorite quotes. When people insist on perfection or nothing, they get nothing. When people insist on what they daydream as a perfect relationship, They end up with no relationship at all. When people waste the time they could have by screaming for more, they will have no time at all. The waste of what could be by demanding what cannot be is something we must put behind us with resolve. Isn't that great? We spend so much of our time working and screaming for the wrong things instead of asking God to make us content with what we have. God helped me in the process of learning to put that in my own life. We had a gal live with us one time, and I had never had anyone live with me, especially a woman that I didn't have a relationship with. She lived with us for 8 months, and God put me through the ringer. That was one of the worst 8 months of my life, because she did not want my love. She would not accept it. And I had to come to the point where she was not going to, and realize that God was not going to use me in that way in her life, and to free her from that expectation. So I took her out to lunch one day, and she introduced me to Chinese food. I'd never had that before. But I went out, and I love it now. But I had Chinese food with her, and I sat down and I said, I apologize to you for having wrong expectations on this relationship. And I realized that where God has you right now is right where He wants you. And I'm going to not pressure you in this area anymore. I'm here if you want me. If you don't, that's fine too. And it just freed up the rest of the relationship. She lived with us 8 months. It didn't get much better after that time. But today that gal's in Hong Kong. Do you know she remembers every single birthday in our family with a card? This year she has written us, I guess, 7 or 8 times with prayer requests. She's laboring. She's involved with women there. But, you know, I never knew anything was going to come of that. All I knew was that God had to do it because I couldn't. But just to relieve that expectation from myself and from her too, because she felt it, you know, here I'm yearning to have this deep, intense relationship, and she didn't want any part of it. And because she's hurting so much, she couldn't accept it. And that was a big help. John 21 was a big help just on accepting people for the way they are. One of the things that happens too, and you that are involved in working with women reps and women who are working on campus, one of the things that we've observed, sometimes when a woman's worker has been working with a woman for a number of years, and then this woman decides to get married, there's a problem that needs to be worked through. Often, real disappointment, the wrong expectations are put on this girl. She's made to feel like a failure because she's gotten out of a commitment and into marriage. So we really need to help those women reps in this area, and I'll say that to them if they're in here too. They need to be very positive with that woman and view it as a relationship of not losing one woman worker, but of gaining a team. And to communicate that and not send this girl on a guilt trip because she's leaving the ministry as that woman sees it. She needs to be taught a broader view of what the ministry is all about. Are we through at 12:30? Is that right? Okay. Okay. Let's move on to the second thing. B, love involves commitment with mutual accountability. One of the things that happened between Ruth and Naomi is I've thought about them and what I'll be like when I get older. I'll probably not be very nice sometime. And I'm sure that Naomi was not very nice a lot of the time that Ruth was serving her. But that was commitment on Ruth's part. But then you see Naomi turning around, doing all that she can to serve Ruth and help her through some tough periods. Christ is our model, and our commitment should reflect His commitment to us, regardless of the stage of spiritual life that we're in. One woman that I'm working with recently had her second child, and the child was born with half a heart and lived 2 weeks. And it was very, very traumatic. This was the girl. She had had two boys, and this was her first girl. And it was very hard for the woman, and in spending some time with her, she said, "Volly, do you know that I, for the first time in my life, am finding out what I'm really like?" And she said, "I don't like who I am. And I don't like God. But I know that He likes me and that He's going to get me through this." See, she needed some friends who would let her share her uglies and still be committed to her. And today, her baby, she got pregnant almost immediately after. Her baby is due again, and she's living in fear. And she's really on my heart these days, because she transferred that experience that happened and said, "The way to remedy this in my life is to have another baby." And that's what she's had, and now she's scared to death. But she needs people that love her, who are going to stand by her and go through this with her, even if it turns out the way it did before. Edith Schaefer makes this point: patience cannot be shown unless there is a circumstance which would make us impatient. Have you ever thought about that? We can be very patient unless something causes us to become impatient. As we go on being committed through tribulation, the love of God becomes more apparent in and through our lives. Just the commitment. One of the women in our survey said this: "I'm sure that apart from a number of tough living situations, I would never have come to appreciate or understand the different styles of communicating love and being loved." And you think about that. Some people communicate love, just all it exudes, you know. Other people are tough, and yet they love you just as much. So we need to appreciate and accept those different styles of love. Another one said, "The joys and sorrows of living in apartments, hours of spontaneous relating, philosophy, analyzing, behind the scenes exposure, helped me to learn and to be accountable to another person, and also to earn the privilege of holding others accountable also." And that's what we do, is earn that privilege. There's a man called Reverend Charles Simeon, and I love what he wrote. He wrote this: someone had rebuked him, and he wrote this note to the man. He said, "I most cordially thank you, my dear friend, for your kind and seasonable reproof. I feel it is both just and necessary, and I will endeavor with God's help to make a suitable improvement of it. If it does not produce its proper effects, I shall be exceedingly thankful to have a second edition of it. I trust that your precious balm will not break my head, but will soften the heart of your indebted friend." And he signed it, "Charles, Proud and Irritable." Don't you love it? It's so real, because we want people to rebuke us, but we don't want them to rebuke us. But we need it. And so if we can get beyond, you know, that other, and recognize we're proud and irritable, but tell me like it is. The ability to share the truth and love at all levels comes with commitment and our security in Christ, so that it doesn't ruffle us. The choice in this area is the willingness to act in humility before God when He lays an issue on our heart through a friend. We'd rather get it direct from God, and He often doesn't do that. Then C, love involves perseverance. Let me share with you. You have in your thing. I'm not going to do that. I'll just look at it real quick. Many decisions for introducing people to Jesus. It looks like this. It's in your little folder. I'll mention a couple of them. This is under perseverance, and this is in your relationships with people, in building relationships. Things that help, and this is from the same gal that did the survey, and her mother-in-law is in this room. Okay, the people that you're building relationships, you don't have one? Many decisions in introducing people to Jesus. Did I leave one? part out? Oh, you did? Okay. All right, they willingly allow you to initiate conversation with them. And they initiate conversation with you. In building relationships with non-Christians, these are sort of gauges. They'll let you serve and help them. This guy next door tries to beat us cutting the grass. It's funny. It really is. Conversation goes beyond facts and ideas about things. And it's progressive. They freely share their opinions about things and they ask your opinions. They'll do something with you that you like. And they'll ask you to do something with them that they like. Ball games or whatever you do. Conversation goes to people and things of personal concern. And I'm not going to go through the rest of it, but at the bottom it says, remember, this is a fluid process. It will not flow in one direction, but will go back and forth and all over. There are no formulas for gaining someone's trust and loving them. That's a real encouragement to you when you think you've made some inroads with someone and you find out you haven't. And you think you have, to remember that it's a fluid process. It's not going to continually go up. It may go way down for a while. But that it's God's job. You know, we're working, doing what He's asked us to do, but it's His job to do the work. Okay, one thing I wanted to mention. Under perseverance, the people that you're involved with, perhaps the women that you've helped, go through a period in their life that Beth Mainhood has called adolescence. In her book, what is her book? Reaching something. Reaching Your World. Okay, I've expanded on that a little bit. And the question that an adolescent asks, the two questions most people are concerned with, Christian or non-Christian, are, does God love me and is God good? And y'all know these. Those are the questions non-Christians have too, after they understand there is a God. But we have them still. Whether you're an infant or growing or adolescence or mature, whatever that means. But the adolescence question is, if I do this, will God continue to love me? And that's what happens when you raise up a woman in the ministry or a couple that you're involved with in the ministry, and they're with you, you grew them, and then they go out on their own. And especially if you're still in the area, there is a tension that develops that's much like what develops with teenagers in your home when you're growing up. Because they are out to prove that they can handle that without you. But they need you too. They need that consistency and that love and that acceptance from you without interference. We've seen that in many of the people that we were involved with. We've blown it with many of the people we're involved with. And still do. There's a book called... Hold Me While You Let Me Go. And that illustrates the principle I'm talking about. When a trainee reaches a certain stage of growth, as that relationship changes, you need to persevere in loving them sort of behind the scenes kind of thing. Okay, the last one under perseverance that I'd like to share, and this is very personal, so I may cry, and if I do, just ignore it because that's part of my life. Has to do with forgiveness. Sometimes, no matter what we do, and before God, I'm trusting that you all do all that you know to do to keep a relationship from going sour. But sometimes it goes sour. And when that happens, I'd like to take you through a little tour that God took me through. It wasn't a one-day thing. It was a long thing that God took me through. And it had to do with more than one relationship, but He kind of focused it for me in several areas. It's called Learning to Love Your Enemies, and you have it in your folders. And during this particular adventure that I went on with God, I entitled the first section, Honesty with God. And what God did with me was He was dealing with me in my life in the area of anger towards someone. And I had been hurt by this person consistently over and over. And I had been forgiving of this person. And then one weekend, or week, we came out here to a crab conference. And Krebs spent much of the week talking about dealing with anger. And I'm a phlegmatic personality, and I don't go up or down very much, and I'd never had a problem with anger before in my life. So I went back home after the conference, and God hit me with anger that was consuming over something that happened that I literally could not get off my mind. And I would have to go out and walk and pray in order to not literally see steam coming out of my head. And that Daryl didn't know what happened to me because he had never seen me this way. He knew what had caused it, but he'd never seen me like that. That was scary to him. And I couldn't do a thing about it. So what I finally did was, says I'm getting nowhere after trying to deal with this with all that I knew to do and taking some of Crad's stuff that I didn't believe in anyway at that point. And so I finally said, okay, I'm just going to get in the Word and God, you do what you want to do with me on this. So I began studying Romans. And I began looking in Romans and I found in Romans this person. And God listed all their sin. And I got through that and I was madder than ever at them because God confirmed all that I knew about them. So I had to go out and walk again and pray. And so then about whenever I got to the next little section, God began to show me my sin. And he says, I think it's the second or third chapter, he says, you who teach others, do you not teach yourself? And he went on and on at me. And it was bad. And I had to walk again. And then, in the process of doing that, God led me to 2 Corinthians 21. I mean, 5:21. Where it says, he has made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God through him. And God just gave me the idea of taking that person's sin, every one of those things that I saw in Scripture, that that person had done, and said, okay, you did this. This person was a Christian. They were not a non-Christian. They knew better. But I took each one of those sins that God had showed me, and I said, okay, you already took those, God, but I'm giving them to you one by one. This one is theirs, and this one is theirs. And then he said, I want yours. So he took all mine that he'd shown me from those Scriptures. And he said, now I'm going to take all those and I give back to you your righteousness, but I'm going to give them their righteousness too. And what happened as a result of that was that God told me I had no right to judge what they had done to me. He had forgiven that already. He'd given them his righteousness. It wasn't mine to worry about. It was his. And not only had he done that, but he had given me the same. I was no better or no worse, and without the grace of God, I would have done exactly what they had done. In the reference I gave you is from Job. Job, and I, like Job, had my eyes opened anew to God's love. Not just for me, but for them. And that I had no right to judge where they were coming from. I had to try to understand him. And to move on to what he did, he didn't stop there with me. This is quite a thing. I went on into Luke 17. I said, okay, Lord, I understand that now. I can forgive now. And I read Luke 17. It says you'd forgive people 70 times 7. The next verse the disciples say, by the way, after he says that, is increase our faith. Because they realize there's no way that they could do that consistently. And so I realized it was possible only by faith. And I said, okay, Lord, I'll do it. And then I said, but Lord, they're going to do it again. And when they do it again, what am I going to do about the hurt that comes to my life because of that? And at that time, he did a crazy thing. I was scratching my arm, and on my arm, I have a 12-inch scar from here to here where I fell through a glass door when I was a little baby. And I got thinking about that scar. And I said, I don't remember doing this. And I don't remember the pain involved in that. And what I realized was that I had been trying to get rid of the pain. And I can't. God is the one who gets rid of the pain. He's the healer for us and for our scars. And so I released that. I did all that I could do, which was forgive by His grace and His power. And it's His job to heal, both on their side and my side, to heal that relationship, because I cannot do it. And it releases you when you recognize that. And moving on down, a way that God used that, God must heal the scars. I can forgive, but God must heal the scars. And the steps for healing, I'll not go into them. I'll share one story with you. A guy that we had in the ministry with us, there was a big rift in the relationship, and he left in a huff after having lived with us on and off for 3 years, and we were very, very close to him. Loved him dearly. And there was a big rift, and he left in a huff, and we didn't have any communication with him except on our initiative in 2 years. But continuing to reach out to him, not in pressuring or anything, just to say hi and let him know we loved him and keep on reaching out for him. 2 years after he left the ministry, we were in North Carolina at our families for Christmas, and we didn't know anyone knew we were there, especially not him. Got a phone call from him. Daryl did. He had traced him down. Their first child had been born dead. And the person he wanted to talk to is Daryl. And we just saw God had healed him because of continuing to reach out and take the initiative. And I'll look at you, you're crying too. You make me worse. And the thing that the decision that we made a number of years ago is that we are going to take the initiative until someone tells us to stay away. And if they tell us to stay away, we'll give them a little time, then we'll try again. And so sometimes people come up to us and say, well, you always are involved with people and you have all these appointments lined up. Do you know who takes the initiative in that? We do. And you take the initiative in calling people. I don't like to call people on the phone, but I call people on the phone because that's part of building that relationship and keeping it going with them. Where are we? Through. We got to quit here. Okay, that's the last one. And then there are others. Support involves faithfulness, deep relationships. Under support, let me mention two things really quick. The emotional capacity of a woman can be limiting, affects how much a woman can handle for how long. So we need one another to help us determine what our capacities are. Often even our husbands don't know what our capacities are. So you need a close friend who can help you in determining your capacity. And support involves contribution. Another survey with a suggestion from the survey is to stick with a person as long as you can until you help them understand what their gifts are. If they're not going to be navigators, don't just drop them. Work with them on opportunities in churches and other missions or whatever till they find a niche that God has planned for them. Instead of dropping, there's so many women out there who are in valleys, who have hung around, both because of marriage. They haven't found that one yet, so they're involved in the ministries, but they haven't really pursued what they want to do in a career. So they're not fulfilled in anything. And so we need to help people to get through that period. If they're not going to be with us on the organization, we need to stick with them and support them and be faithful to them until such time as they are feeling comfortable. You can't do that with every person because you are limited in your capacity, and I have lost my place. The last thing you have in here, and I'll just make a suggestion on how to use it. It's from Jerry and Mary's book on friends and friendship, and it's the friendship test. And you can at your leisure when you get home. You can take this test, and I'd suggest two ways. Take it in relationship to your navigator, peers, and then take it in relationship to your non-Christian friends, assuming you have a number of those. So, qualities of unity, love, and support enable us to work together as women in harmony, hopefully, in God's kingdom. You have a question, Joan? Anybody? Okay. Somebody pray. Marley, you want to pray?